Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer.
All right, everybody. Today we have two very special guests with us. We have Oscar-winning producer Deborah Oppenheimer and Oscar-winning writer-director Mark Jonathan Harris. Previously, they've collaborated on the documentary Into the Arms of Strangers, Stories of the Kinder Transport, which won the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. And today, they're here to talk to me about their new documentary, Foster, which gives a unique, compelling look inside our foster care system. Foster is going to debut on HBO May 7th at 8 p.m. I want to thank you both for being here with me and for pointing your lens at our corner of the world.
You're welcome.
Happy to be here.
Thanks. So when I first saw the preview for Foster, I got really excited. And my first thought was, where did this come from? Who made it? So I looked it up and saw it had been made by real filmmakers. I got very excited at that point. And immediately my first question that popped to mind was, what could have brought you to this subject? So Deborah, can you tell me, what was it that made you decide to look at foster care?
I was doing volunteer work in a local public school, and I met a little boy named Patrick, who was 6 years old at the time. He was a very bright, buoyant, happy child, and already showed impressive signs of leadership at the time. And I spent some time working in the class with a number of the kids, and when I thought that I had completed my work and was walking out the door and asked Patrick's story, I discovered that he was living in a local orphanage, that he had been removed from his parents' home. And the sound of the word orphanage was just shocking to me. And I went home sobbing and resolved to continue to see him. And it's been 25 years now. He just turned 31 years old. And so I had never encountered the system before and believed that most of the people I knew had also never encountered a foster youth, a social worker, or the foster care system.
Yeah. Wow. Did you then approach Mark with the idea? Or Mark, what did you think when you came to the idea of foster care as a subject?
Well, Deborah and I have wanted to work together again since Into the Arms of Strangers. And I've always been drawn to stories of children experiencing trauma that is produced at the hands of adults, produced by circumstances beyond their control. I've written books and done films about children dealing with poverty, homelessness, war, other problems that they're not responsible for, but they have to cope with it. And I'm really interested in how they respond to these very traumatic situations. And I'm particularly interested in resilience because I think children do have amazing resources and can rebound from really difficult situations like this. Foster care is certainly a perfect example of this. Children don't go into foster care through any fault of their own, although they often think that they must have had something to do with it. They've been bad children. They take on that responsibility because they don't know any other way of understanding what's happened to them.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what we deal with, is the trauma from whatever happens in the home and then the secondary trauma of them being in foster care. But Mark, I wanted to ask you, in the filmmaking process, did you have a general plan of where you wanted to go, or did it just sort of develop as you followed these people in this film through their lives?
No, we had a clear plan, and that's why we chose these five stories. Deborah and I researched this for approximately 2 years before we began filming. First of all, we had to get access, which is, I'm sure you know, very, very difficult because of issues of child privacy. And we had to get everybody to buy into allowing us to film. I'm sure Deborah can talk more about this.
Yeah, Deborah, how did you all gain access to the system because it's so closed down to the public?
I think we went everywhere that we were invited. We spoke to everyone who would speak to us. And I think after a while, we gained people's trust with our approach, that we believed that there was no film like this that existed, that very often in the press or in projects that people undertake about the system, the public learns their information at a time of crisis, at a time of a fatality. And we believed that as a result of that, people despair. They give up at what they perceive to be the enormity and the hopelessness of what's going on. And so we hoped by putting a human face on it to turn that despair to engagement. And when we could articulate that along with our credentials, Mark's history, the books he had written, Patrick being in my life, I think in time people put their trust in us and they saw that we took that extremely, extremely seriously. We took that as an enormous responsibility.
So once we had permission to shoot, by that time we had a good idea of some kind of universal stories to tell. And then we looked for characters, subjects. We wanted to depict a family losing a child, the earliest instance, and that's the story of Chris and Rayanne, whose child is taken away at birth because the child is born with drugs in her system. Then we wanted to see what happened to a child who was taken away, and that's Mary's story. And we picked Mary up at 18 after she's been in the foster care system basically all her life, more homes than she can actually count or remember. Then we wanted to find an exemplary foster mother, and we were also interested in dual system kid, somebody who was in foster care who got in trouble for an infraction that if he had been in an intact family would have been de-escalated and he would have been punished at home, but instead he ends up with a felony and put in juvenile detention. And then finally, you know, Jessica's story, here's a social worker who had been in the system as a child and then decided to become a social worker. And we were clued into this kind of story. First of all, Jessica's an extraordinary person, really remarkable.
Yes.
But we had done many, many interviews with social workers in preparation for doing this film. We discovered that many of the people in this field fall into the wounded healer syndrome. They had had bad experiences in their childhood, or they had come from dysfunctional families where there had been domestic abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction, sometimes even worse, and they couldn't repair the problems in their own family. So they became social workers later on, trying to repair that damage in other families.
Right, right.
And I think Jessica's an example. Jessica's certainly an example of that.
Yeah, and you certainly captured.
And then what we also did was we worked extremely close. I mean, the number of lawyers involved in this film are quite extensive because, as you know, everybody has a lawyer. The children have lawyers. The parents have lawyers. The social workers have lawyers. And so one of the things that we did in working on the privacy issues that Mark referenced before is we worked with Children's Law Center, with Leslie Heimoff and the attorneys there, to devise paperwork that is required when you have a movie that you're going to put into theaters or on HBO. You have to have permissions in place, but the lawyers were also quite vigilant about the privacy concerns and protecting the children in that way. But also, because we set out to include minors with open cases that we were warned we might not be able to do, there was an issue of awareness and understanding of what they were getting involved in. And so obviously for Kristen, the little newborn baby, you can't have that sign off. But in the case of Sydney and Denisha, who are 12 and 13 years old, there was a conversation about that their story would be told, it would be made known to other people, and was that acceptable to them? Was that of interest to them? And Mrs. Beavers, this remarkable foster parent, took a vote in the household, and the girls decided that they wanted to be part of the film, along with this question of whether we would be allowed to film minors. We had to put through a media request, a petition to the court, and there were 35 signatures on every petition that had to go through, with extensive groups of people being allowed to sign off on whether this could move forward. And when we were warned about concealing people's faces potentially, what's called pixelating or putting them in silhouette the way you sometimes see people, Mark devised wording on the petition about the eyes being the window to the soul. And we made a very persuasive, compelling argument to the courts and to all the permission holders about why we wanted to do this. And we were fortunate that they came to understand the value and the need of it. We also had a presiding judge at the time, Judge Michael Nash, who had been on the bench for 25 years, and he believed in a transparent court. He would always try to invite press and other people in to see the goings-on in court, and was disappointed that not more people took him up on the offer. But that was very much to our advantage, that he saw the worthiness of this film as well.
That's great. I know we're familiar with the excellent Children's Law Center of Los Angeles out there. I've been out there to observe their work. What was your impression of their impact on the system and the kids?
We're knocked out by their dedication. We worked with Leslie Hymoff and all four film directors, Jennifer Chung Marino, David Estep, Ivy Carey, and Phyllis. Oh my gosh, I just forgot Phyllis's name, but I'll tell you it in a moment to give her proper credit. Phyllis Strickland, we were very impressed with the dedication, and we not only got to work with the attorneys, we got to work with peer advocates. They have people working within the firms who have experienced the system and that are now, as Mark said, working from within to reform. We got to work with an unbelievably eloquent and impressive case manager like Lenny Wilson, who you see as a part of the support team. So the work that's being done by Children's Law Center was really quite impressive and dedicated. And they guided us. They guided us tremendously, informed us, educated us, and were protective, fiercely protective of their clients, of the children.
Yeah, they do great work out there. They really do. And, of course, they represent a population the size of a small country. It's one of the biggest
yeah.
systems.
It's quite a huge law firm.
Yeah.
And now that was one of the things that I think we hadn't anticipated, the size of the child welfare system in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is this huge county, and they serve so many clients. And the system is so complicated. I mean, Leslie Hymoff at the very beginning of our research said, you need a navigator to be able to wend your way through this complex system.
Mm-hmm. And she was very tough on us. She held us, understandably, to a very, very high standard. She was, I mean, the lawyers and all those people were among the first people who we met with. And we should also talk about Los Angeles dependency lawyers, the lawyers for the parents. We met with Ken Krikorian very early on and understood the enormous challenges of representing the parents and their dedication to parents who have had their children removed. Mark, you can talk about a parent who has had their child removed, maybe?
Yes. I mean, the worst thing for a child is to be removed from family and home. And I think the worst thing for a mother is to have her child taken away from her. I mean, this is there's terrible pain on both sides. And, you know, I think, you know, if we talk about how to reform and restructure the child welfare system, I think many people would agree now that it's important to intervene early rather than in crisis, that we need to move to a more preventative public health model to help struggling families stay together rather than intervene only when the family has really fallen apart. Then it's often very late. And I think a lot of children say, I wish you had been able to help my mom or dad before I got taken away from their family.
Right. Yeah, it's a very reactive system as opposed to proactive. And foster care has just kind of grown up like a weed in this country as opposed to a garden. We just kind of react to the crisis, and now we have the system we have.
Right.
Hopefully.
Absolutely.
Hopefully raising awareness like this is going to lead to some rethinking. I was curious, though. I mean, in the film is beautifully shot, and if the goal of a documentary is to reveal truth, there's so many moments in the film that do that. But one that really sticks with us is the foster mother, Mrs. Beavers, when she says that with these broken kids, they need more than love. They need long-suffering love. That's got to be one of the probably the best description I've ever heard of what these kids need to heal. Because we deal with foster parents and adoptive parents struggling all the time to figure out what these kids need. And I'm wondering, when a person like this says something like that in your filming, do you realize at that moment that that's golden? That's like something a screenwriter
would
write?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. We made a decision not to have a narrator. In the beginning, we interviewed dozens of researchers and academics who were dedicated toward early childhood and data and trauma and brain science. And we did get an excellent education, and we thought that those people would be on the edges of the movie trying to contextualize and explain things. And ultimately, we made a decision not to have a narrator. So it was extremely important that people express concepts and ideas that we had been introduced to. So every time Lanny, the case manager, or Barbara Dewey, when she spoke about it not being fair that Dasani had charges against him instead of punishment, or Mrs. Beavers talking about once you remove a child, you introduce all this trauma. We knew as they said that those were extremely important concepts. We also had 150 hours of film that we had to cut down to less than 2 hours. So we hope everybody will see that everything that's in the movie is important to understand and to know, and how to introduce that to the public. Who we needed to make a decision of, who is our audience? Is our audience for the children and the people in the system? Is our audience for the advocates and the workers? Or is our audience for an uninformed public who is just coming to this subject for the first time? And so in the end, we decided where we have to pin down and make a decision about one constituency, it was for the public. So we did recognize that those were important concepts to convey.
We, in the beginning, we thought we might need academic experts, but then we realized that the people in the field, they were experts on the basis of their experience. They had learned all this from their years in the system, from perspectives as client and as helper. So, I mean, we also knew from the very beginning, and Deborah knew from her own experience, that the most important thing in a life of a foster child is one consistent, caring adult. Deborah has been the consistent adult presence in Patrick's life, and that's made all the difference. You need somebody who is there when you mess up, who accepts you, no matter what kind of trouble you get into, and who is there, who believes in you and believes in your potential. I mean, that's what good parenting does.
Yeah, that was kind of one of the things I took from the film, was that message. You know, documentary filmmaking seems to often have an element of activism to it. Is that something you both intended with this film?
Yes, absolutely.
Very much.
The participant media, which is one of the funders of our film, is known for making documentaries about the important social issues of our time. They did, I have an incredible track record from Inconvenient Truth in the documentary realm to Spotlight in the fictional narrative film. And they've undertaken a really very strong impact campaign to take this film to 10 states at the beginning and bring it to the attention of people in the child welfare field, to legislators, to people in nonprofits, to people of influence who can help bring about reform in the system, in addition to bringing this to the widest public audience to bring awareness of this issue. So that's what they're dedicated to.
Yeah, and along with part of that outreach campaign, we have worked with Prudence Baedler Carr, who's the Director and Chief Counsel at the American Bar Association Center on Children and the Law, and they have fully embraced this film, put it out to their membership, had us come and speak to them. And we are aware that the film is shot entirely in Los Angeles County, but it's not meant to be about Los Angeles County practices or statutes. And we know that not all states have extended care for foster youth. In California we do, but I believe it's 29 states that currently have it. And we know the critical differences it makes in child well-being for every year that it's extended. We also know that not all states provide the representation for the children, the parents, the social workers. So we, for your audience, for the field that this podcast is directed to, the differences that this film could make are quite significant and measurable and tangible that we hope it can help with. The other thing that is happening is that the most sweeping change to legislation in family preservation and child welfare has taken place, got passed in February of last year, the Family First Prevention Services Act. And we always like to point out that the child welfare system and foster care is a bipartisan, bicameral issue. And you have leadership at the Senate Finance Committee led by Senator Chuck Grassley and Senator Ron Wyden, and also in the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Family Worker and Family Support led by Congressman Danny Davis and Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, coming together along with 500 organizations and many other people to pass this important legislation that moves toward the preventative model, that changes the funding to move it more upstream to help with drug addiction and mental health services for the parents, so that where safe and advisable and possible, children don't need to be removed and family can get the support they need. one of the really interesting things to me when we first started was you had the presiding judge, Michael Nash, and you had Ken Krikorian from Los Angeles Dependency Lawyers, and you had Leslie Heimoff from Children's Law Center present to us separately the very provocative question of, if you have a child who's clean, who's healthy, who's nicely dressed, who's showing up at school every day, doing the homework, achieving in school, and their parents have a drug problem, what do you do? Do you remove that child? And that was particularly interesting to me, that these three people representing three constituencies all actually agree on the answer to that question. And that was very early on, almost 4 or 5 years ago in our research, that was presented to us, and we came to understand the complexity of this very, very, very human system where you have human beings making a decision and where you're standing between two people who have a different narrative that they're telling you of what has happened in their family and how does a social worker decide whether to remove or not.
Right. Yeah, As Jessica says
in the film, this job is hard as hell.
Yep. I think she summed it up nicely. She really did. Perfectly.
In her case, the help that she got came from the Alliance for Children's Rights, where she graduated testing at the third grade math level and thought she was very stupid. And they stepped in, because they gave a $25 Target gift card. She had no interest in coming to this nonprofit, but she was lured by the prospect of getting the gift card. And once there, she met one of their advocates, Barbara Fasher, and also the then head of the organization, Janice Speier, who never gave up on her and never judged her. And she went from this academic level to getting a master's in social worker and advocating from within.
Yeah, she's such a testament to never giving up on a human being, which is kind of what the whole field is about. But I so appreciate your guys' time today. I know I have to let you go. May, of course, is National Foster Care Month, meant to raise awareness on behalf of the kids in the system. And this is how you raise awareness, this film. This is how it's done.
We hope so. We hope there will be more causes. We'll never know if more people go into law or becoming judges as a result of seeing this film. But we do hope that it can impact people's engagement according to whatever level is comfortable for them. There are so many ways to get involved, and we hope people will leave the theater feeling that like they'd like to do something.
I believe they will. Deborah Oppenheimer, Mark Jonathan Harris, thank you both so much for joining me today and for making this very important film. Foster debuts May 7th on HBO. Get your coworkers, your friends, your family, and have a watch party. Let's raise some awareness of this system. Thank you both so much for joining me.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.